You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme, we'll talk through the day's top news stories with our special guest today, Isabel Hilton and James Schneider. Following this morning's firefight outside the US consulate in Istanbul, we examine Turkey and America's complex entanglements in an increasingly violent region. Donald Trump is one man who believes he has the answer to defeat Islamic State, but it involves sending in ground troops and stealing their oil. We ask, when it comes to political statements, how stupid is too stupid? And later on, following New Zealand's long search for a new flag design, a committee has finally whittled down 10,000 potential options to a long list of 40. We throw our hat into the ring and pick our favourite. All that and more, starting right now on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are regular Monocle 24 contributors, Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and James Schneider, senior correspondent at New African magazine. Welcome both to the programme. Well, we're going to start today's discussion in Turkey, which has suffered a number of violent attacks today. This morning, two women attacked the US consulate in Istanbul, shooting at security officials near the large compound. Meanwhile, a vehicle packed with explosives attacked a police station on the other side of the city. All of this comes, of course, as America sent six F-16 fighters and hundreds of soldiers to Incirlik Air Base, following a deal with the Turkish government to help fight Islamic State militants. Isabel, in this complex game of who's backing who in that region, who do we think is to blame for these attacks?
Well, the claim is that at least the attack on the consulate was carried out by two women who belonged to a fairly obscure leftist, anti-American, extreme left group in Turkey, which may well be true. I don't think that they're major players, but I think that what they're a symptom of is the very fragile state of Turkey, which I think can only really get worse. I think one of the effects of the instability and multiple conflicts in the region is that this state, which, like a lot of other states, has been held together and concealed a whole series of incipient conflicts within it. I mean, clearly, you know, the Kurds we know about, but there are all sorts of cross currents and tensions in the Turkish polity, which are beginning to surface with the regional conflict. And I'm very much afraid that I think Turkey is going to be a major casualty of the regional instability, and that's very serious.
James, it's fascinating what Isabel is saying, because I think for many years we've looked at Turkey thinking, you know, it's slowly moving towards Western Europe, and that there was a key struggle between, you know, the liberals, the non-religious Turks, and, you know, a more moderate Islamist group of people. But now what we've seen over the past few months has hinted that, you know, within Turkey there are many people who are not so moderate, who are certainly backers of Islamic State in some form, even if it's only to rankle, you know, the Kurds. And there seem to be so many kind of conflicts, as Isabel is saying. Do you think that the same, that we're beginning to see that, you know, Erdogan, you know, has tried to be the strong man of his country, and it's just not working anymore?
In one sense, it isn't. It's not quite working, that he doesn't quite have the support that he used to, and he can't govern alone, and he can't do things like change the constitution and so on. But I don't think the country appears to be fully falling apart. In fact, in some ways, I've been surprised by how few there's perhaps been. It's not fully sure. There's perhaps been one ISIS attack within Turkey so far, given that Turkey's border with Syria for quite some time was deliberately very porous. People could go to and from so that fighters could reach the front line to fight against Assad. And there's been quite significant, it appears, recruiting of people from Turkey to ISIS. And very clearly, it's been one of the routes, the main route for people from outside the region to get in to join ISIS. That there has been, as Turkey amps up its involvement in the front against ISIS, that less has happened. I mean, there are clearly these different frictions, and we're going to have to see a lot more of what's going on with the Kurdish issue, and I think that's going to be a major fault line within Turkish politics and its military relations as well. And that does interact in some peculiar ways with ISIS. But so far, it's not, I mean, I would have expected to have suffered far worse terrorist attacks by this stage.
But I think, yes, forgive me, but I think that that ISIS and Erdogan have common cause in seeing the main enemy as the Kurds. I don't think that ISIS sees the Turkish state at this point as its enemy, and the Turkish state, Erdogan's government, appears to have been, you know, covertly assisting ISIS in all sorts of ways. And you can see that there's a sort of logic from his perspective. What is, you know, bizarre and completely unsustainable, I think, is the notion that Turkey is an ally against ISIS. In these circumstances, if you look at who Turkey is bombing, it has bombed the Kurds now several hundred times. It has bombed ISIS a couple of times. So, you know, I don't think that there's any great mystery here as to why the Turkish state has not suffered more attacks from ISIS.
At this stage, but also, I mean, yes, this is all very, very much the case. But I think as Turkey becomes, and it will, I think, be somehow forced into doing so, also Erdogan, as he plays his relationship off with the West, as in both, he has to be somewhat critical, but he also has to be a friend also as part of NATO. That risk does increase. I know he's very firmly been of the position that we don't really attack ISIS so much because we need Assad to fall first, and that's always been his priority, which is, you know, perhaps not going to happen anytime soon still.
And for both of you, what do you feel about the role of the US here? Because they've been pulled in, you know, they've wanted to be pulled in. They've wanted to have some freedom to attack Islamic State. But now they've kind of signed up to this deal with Turkey, which puts this, you know, this barrier, this border zone where, you know, it's going to be supposedly demilitarized. It's going to be a buffer zone. But that includes, you know, attacking, as you say, the Kurds. So in a way, have they got in a bit of a mess here themselves? Should, you know, is this a worthy deal? You know, the idea that yes, they can attack Islamic State, but they turn a blind eye to what's happening to the Kurds.
I think it's a very bad bargain because the Americans also need the Kurds. I mean, who is fighting Islamists in Iraq? You know, who is the most effective force on the ground where the United States doesn't wish to put troops? It's a very, very bad bargain if they're seen to be backing the Turkish attack on the Kurds, because they also need the Kurds.
There was a really good report today in the New York Times looking at how the Kurds are working very closely with the American troops, very efficiently, phoning in coordinates to, you know, some remote base where suddenly they call in the bombers, and it's working. The Kurds are gaining territory. And, you know, they do seem to be the hope at pushing back Islamic State. So without them, it seems terrifying that, you know, the US has ended up in a deal that could potentially, you know, damage the Kurds. And it's very hard for outsiders to work out the logic of, you know, what Erdogan wants, what's happening in the region, don't you think, James?
Yeah, I agree. And I think the first priority of trying to work out any of the next moves is to untangle several moves back and see how everything is interconnected and how you are undermining how several moves have undermined the position going forward. And I think this is a preeminent example.
Now, in the race to be US president, and one gentleman has been making quite a lot of statements that gather headlines for one reason or another, but he's also dived into the debate about what's happening with ISIS, and that is, of course, Donald Trump. And he was speaking on MSNBC's Morning Joe program, and here's what he had to say.
They have great money because they have oil. They have much oil. Every place where they have oil, I would put boots on the ground, I would knock the hell out of them, but I'd put a ring around it and I'd take the oil for our country.
Well, he's a little bit outspoken and a little bit simplistic in his approach. But oddly, is he that wrong? You know, is the key to, you know, strangling Islamic State not so much about kind of bombing everywhere, but by somehow cutting them off from their oil supplies?
No, I don't think. I mean, also, his quote then goes on to say, "We'll just surround them, and then we'll take their oil back for our country." I mean, it's Donald Trump isn't actually running for president; he's a conceptual artist, and it's all a really, really interesting joke. It'll all come out, and it will win the Turner Prize. But no, I think it's been quite overstated the the amount of oil that they can get out. Yes, there is some, there are the estimates between $1 million and $5 million a day. It's not an insubstantial sum of money. But also, for the amount of space that they have to govern, that's not the only thing that they have, and it's also insufficient for them to fully govern it. I think that anything which... they should be beaten militarily first. That's got to happen, and it's got to be done in a way which doesn't bring further people to their cause. And saying things like "we're going to go and steal their oil," well, sorry, not steal, we're going to go take their oil for our country, obviously adds to the other cause. And also, how is he going to go and put these boots on the ground around all of these small oil wells and hold them, and then put a ring around that, and then those installations not get bombed? It's not in any way. Well, I can't even believe I'm going to say that it's not a consistent, coherent strategy, because it's Donald Trump who's saying it. So of course it isn't a coherent, consistent strategy.
As well, let's give the man one last bit of credit. Boots on the ground at any point?
Pretty tricky, I think. I think that there was a Lieutenant General Hertling who, I think, with admirable understatement, said of Donald Trump's remarks, "You have to understand the issues a little better than just bombing things." and did point out that actually these oil fields belong to Iraq, a country that Trump also said didn't exist. So I think, you know, he is the gift that goes on giving, but let's not scramble our brains too much in dismantling his foreign policy.
Okay, we won't give him marks out of 10 on that one, I think, because I know what the score is going to be. But finally, before we take a short break, China's foreign minister is currently finishing up his trip to West Africa, visiting countries affected hardest by the Ebola crisis that killed more than 11,000 people. China gave more than $100 million in aid to fight Ebola there, also sending in hundreds of doctors. James, they've promised more support for these countries. Do we take this at face value? A good thing? They seem to have been genuinely supportive of the crisis in the region.
Yeah, China has played a positive role in the Ebola crisis. It moved a lot faster than every other country other than Cuba in providing doctors and nurses that were sent over to man the Ebola facilities, which is exactly what was required. And that was a large part of how the virus then got under control, was when France, the US and the UK then basically copied this strategy and built quite large clinics and sent over a lot of medical personnel. So they get a lot of credit for that. I don't think you can see anything too malign in what they're doing now. They're extending their assistance. And if you look at the sort of investment packages that they're talking about with Liberia, for example, building some roads, not only are those useful, extremely useful, positive things to be built, but they're saying we're looking for partners to do them as well. So this road that's meant to run along the coast to go to Ivory Coast could very well end up being a, let's say, French-Chinese built road. They're playing a far more... It's a far more nuanced and far more collaborative role on the continent, at least with respect to a lot of big ticket things like Ebola, like infrastructure.
Isabel, do you agree? Do you think there's a maturing of the way that they use business and aid and, well, to win friends and do good things in the region?
Up to a point. Certainly the Ebola response was very good, and there has been a maturing of the Chinese position in several respects, but you also note that the minister criticised comments about corruption, and I think that, you know, this brings us back to the very early position of the Chinese, where they were going into countries where looking for resources, essentially. Now they're going into countries looking for resources and business. They have a lot of overcapacity that they need to export, and the deals are extremely opaque. And these are complaints from, you know, local press that they simply can't find out what the deals were. And when you say that outsiders are not allowed to comment on corruption, I mean, you are looking at things. There was a stretch of four kilometre stretch of road in Sierra Leone, which the Chinese built, for which the government of Sierra Leone paid $18 million. Which is a unit price of about $4.5 million a kilometre, when the standard international price for a stretch of road is $250,000. So clearly this is a deal in which the Chinese contractors and the government of Sierra Leone both benefited, but they, you know, it's not very good for the people. So I think that I welcome all kind of maturing of the Chinese approach, but I think that we are still hitting a fundamental problem here in which the Chinese seek to gain a competitive advantage by not questioning the conduct of the government or the contract.
You wanted to come in?
I think the Chinese do that. I think lots of other actors, including Western actors, also do the same thing. If we look at Liberia, for example, they have had big mining asset deals, for example, that have been signed off in the Senate in closed session where none of the information gets out, and with Indian and with Western companies, not with Chinese. This is a problem that faces the continent as a whole with all of its supposed partners. I mean, partners is probably a misnomer in many ways if the structures of the deal are antithetical to the long-term interests of the majority of the people in the country, which many of these deals from China or from the US or from anyone else are. I think part of the problem with how we look at Chinese engagement with Africa from a Western perspective often is we're comparing it with the West as opposed to looking at how it fundamentally benefits or not. So we get caught up in, yes, they make the comment about corruption, which is the backhanded way of criticizing Obama, because he did a backhanded criticism of China when he gave his speech to the African Union. That kind of surface level jousting is significantly less important than the deals, but also what we're seeing more and more is Chinese and other multinational companies are working together in many ways for their interests, and there this whole divide of the Western approach and the Chinese approach slightly breaks down, and we're seeing this other way, which is the international agent, actors engaging with the African continent.
James, just quickly tell me, when we often see reports in the press, Zambia, Botswana, protests by local people feeling that the Chinese come, but they kind of living their encampments, they don't put money into communities while they're working on projects, and a sense that they kind of then bring in a kind of a level of traders who flood the local market with everything from flip flops to plastic buckets. When we see those stories, are those stories just, the West hoping that that's true and kind of building up small scuffles? Or is there a real sense of resentment across Africa about some of this investment from China?
Some of those stories are absolutely true. The stuff about Chinese workers and encampments and so on, that stuff is significantly less true than that gets overemphasized. The things that are true are the small traders that are coming in, the undercutting of domestic production by Chinese imports into Africa, and also which comes with Chinese traders. That's a big issue. That also, it's difficult for the Chinese government to be involved in that, because that's often very small scale Chinese entrepreneurs who are coming in. It's a different thing to these big state owned companies. And the other one that is real, is legitimate, and this is somewhere where there does appear to be a quantitative difference between a Chinese employer and a non-Chinese employer in mines. The Chinese labor conditions tend to be worse or more onerous than those in other countries, and that a lot of what we're seeing are labor disputes breaking out. And if you take Zambia, it's not just against the Chinese owners of factories or Chinese managers that there have been labor disputes. They're disproportionately against Chinese because their labor conditions are worse. But there have also been that against Indian-owned mines, Canadian-owned mines, and so on, because that's essentially what the antagonism is. And then it's got this kind of Chinese flavor as opposed to being essentially Chinese.
And Isabel, before we just quickly go to the break, again, when we come back to this and the notion of the Ebola work, do you think that the Chinese are actually a bit bad at doing their own PR? Because actually, I didn't really widely read that story about them setting up hospitals and doing things on the ground. Should they have been inviting in CNN and the likes, to come see what they're doing? Because this image we have of China is pretty
predatory. Yeah. Yes, I agree. And I think, that there's a longer term problem, however, that the Chinese control of their own story is, we react against it as propaganda, and they're not very good at opening up and allowing, a critical scrutiny from Western press. In fact, less and less so. There's a tremendously sort of anti-foreign feeling in China at the moment coming from the top. And the problem with that is that Chinese soft power and the Chinese telling of its own story tends to be the harder for it, because they have a problem of credibility. And if you note, there was a survey the other week which ranked the effectiveness of soft power, and China spends far more on soft power than almost anybody. And isn't really making much headway for that reason, that to invite CNN in, which would, I think, would have been a very good idea, and, you know, get the deserved praise that they should have had, is just, it's slightly difficult. They would rather have Xinhua put out a story and then people read it and say, well, it's a Xinhua story, you know. So take it with a pinch of salt.
Well, fascinating stuff. But we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck. James Schneider and Isabel Hilton will still be here when we return. Stay tuned.
Hello. Have we been introduced properly? We should get to know each other a bit better. We're Monocle 24, the radio station brought to you from the makers of Monocle magazine, the global print title that was launched in 2007 to deliver a briefing on everything from affairs to design. Headquartered in London, Monocle has built up a network of bureaux in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, Istanbul, New York, and Toronto. And we also run our own stores and cafes where you can get a good coffee, a nice cake, and a copy of the magazine too. Then there's Monocle.com, where you can listen to this radio station and all our archived shows, watch the films made by our film team, and visit our e-commerce store. Intrigued? I just knew we'd get along.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, at half an hour is now shorter, sweeter, new and improved. Where else can you end up informed and entertained after half an hour? By watching a quarter of Oscar-winning The Theory of Everything, by reading the first 20 pages of Kazuo Ishiguro's new novel, by speed-walking through a thousandth of the Venice Biennale, not on your Nelly. Culture with Robert Bound, smaller and even more perfectly formed.
This is what people do for a living, right? They put their shows on. This is the show of shows.
Culture premieres at 1900 hours London time on Mondays.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And still with me is Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and James Schneider, senior correspondent at New African magazine. Well, to Tehran now, where it's expected we'll soon get a verdict in the trial of the imprisoned journalist Jason Rezaian. Jason, who worked as a correspondent for the Washington Post, has been charged with espionage in the country and has been held in Iran's infamous Evin prison for more than a year. He faces up to two decades in jail. Where do we think this will lead? Do you think this is a bargaining chip, Isabel? Do you think it's likely that he will be, you know, sent to jail, but we'll see him swapped in some former future negotiations?
It's a bit tricky, isn't it? I think he may have started as a bargaining chip, but the situation, the wider situation, has moved on in significant ways with the nuclear deal. And I think that it would be unfortunate if he were sentenced to 20 years at this point, because, of course, that would inflame those in the United States who are already going to make it as hard as possible for the nuclear deal to prosper. It's a gift to, those who, the opponents of the nuclear deal. So if I were the Iranian government, I would be deeply concerned that the judge in this instance is a very, very hardline judge. And whilst I wouldn't normally be advocating interference with the judiciary as a matter of principle, I'm prepared to make an exception in this case. There are very, very high stakes, not just for the accused, but actually for Iran and for Iran's wider future. If he is sentenced, to 20 years, he will appeal, and I think that would be the point at which the Iranian government might be able to exercise some discretion, and I would strongly suspect that they would be inclined to do so.
James, it's interesting. Yeah, we're giving lots of nice PR to Iran these days. Everyone's talking about, you know, the world of retail and how it could open up for hotels, and it's like a nice place to go on your holiday. But you forget it's still one of the countries that executes more people than anywhere else in the world. It's still a tough, brutal regime in many places. When we see a trial like this, you know, in a way, is it good actually that we do kind of sit up and think, actually, you know, this, we do need to remember that there is another Iran. It's not all, you know, the smiley faces that we've been seeing of late.
Yes, I think that's the problem. When you get a pretty thin understanding of a country, it can flip so much so quickly. And you had a deeply shallow, how can something be deeply shallow? An extremely shallow understanding of the country beforehand. It's this crazed place with mullahs and religious police going around attacking everyone, and it's evil, and they're trying to destroy the Middle East and so on and so forth, and they want to wipe Israel off the face of the earth and so on. And then you get instead, as we're having now, ice cream in North Tehran and nice parties up in the hills and all of this kind of stuff. And neither of those are really true. So, yes, I mean, part of the having to convince people that you need to talk to Iran is you do have to show that it isn't, you have to undo this work that has been done saying they're all just mad mullahs. It's not as if it's this perfect country where that doesn't have enormous human rights abuses, that it doesn't have this seemingly pretty arbitrary arrest of a journalist that does execute people for homosexuality. I mean, those things can't ever be put aside. I think the way that the Iran should be engaged with is sort of friendly and robustly at the same time. You say, look, these are our interests, this is what we're trying to do, and here are the ways in which we fundamentally disagree with you, and we think these things have to be improved.
Well, we'll be certainly be bringing you the news as the court reaches its decision. But finally today, in the long search for a new Kiwi flag, well, they're almost there, actually, with a long list of 40 options chosen by a committee from a pool of more than 10,000 designs. New Zealanders have been submitting their own design creations, and they've ranged from the serious to the absurd. Now, it's a tricky thing choosing a new flag. We have the 40 that have been published, and what happens is it goes to a ballot in November, December, and then the winning one goes up against the existing flag next year, and then they decide if they keep the existing one, they get a new one. But we've all seen the 40 new designs. The common themes are, you know, there's a lot of ferns going on, which is the popular popular symbol. We like a bit of gardening here. When you've looked at the 40 options, Isabel, was there one that, James, would you like to go first? Was there one that stuck out from you? Is there any that appealed to you?
I think there are a number of them that look sort of fine. There's one particular one that's black with a white line across it with the stars, which looks, I would say, definitely do not go for that. There's one that looks far too much like the cricket symbol. I wouldn't go for that. The one I'm really upset that didn't make the long list, it's my favourite from the however many it was that they submitted, the 10,000, is one that looks like it was done on paint, where there's a bird shooting green lasers out of its eyes at something.
It's a kiwi.
How could I not know that? It's not just a fruit, it's okay. A little bird with laser with laser vision. And that's really, I think that sums up the whole Kiwi spirit. The New Zealanders, they have laser vision in their eyes, they can see the future, and they're going to give us something brilliant.
Well, they've kind of gone, it's either a full frond, or you can have a little curl of a fern frond. And I think that they're kind of all right. There's one or two which go a bit too far. That looks more like a kind of nose ring or a nipple ring. Nipple ring. This one looks like a warning sign, like about danger,
there are two
tunnel
that
ahead.
Look, there are two that look like road signs. And I have to say, I'm a bit suspicious of this selection committee, because they've really cut it down to, you know, kind of three basic types, which are, and they're pretty samey, the ones that they've picked. Whereas the ones they didn't pick are really a whole bunch of fun. You know, as James said, kiwis with lasers, hey, go for it.
Now, there's been apparently some real discussion, because they thought they were going to go for a black background, but now because of ISIS kind of stealing...
Black flags are really out.
That branding has changed dramatically. So they don't think they're going to go out of the way. Do you think that you should have a flag you can draw? Because we were talking earlier, I think what's nice about the Swiss flag and the Japanese flag is, you know, if you're a kid, you can draw it when you're 5 years old.
It's got to be instantly recognisable. Yeah. It has to appeal when people see it. I think a couple of those could maybe work, but something that is too complicated and won't go down.
I don't think any of them really say New Zealand to me. I don't. What is the curl? What is the curl about?
That's a bit more fern frond. It could be it's a little bit Maori as well. I quite like that. It's a bit of a hint of Maori in there. Mm-hmm. But you see, the other trouble about the leaf, if you draw it badly, it might look like a dope leaf, mightn't it? It might just like, you know, New Zealand's open for hashish or something.
Yes, I think anyone trying to draw the more realistic fern fronds is going to go, not good in primary one.
I've got a feeling the existing flag may survive. Anyway, we're going to leave it there. That's all on today's show. I have special thanks to James Schneider, senior correspondent at New African Magazine, and of course, Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, with their take on the top news today. And, well, this show, it was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Elena Nikolacheva. And also Federica Romianella. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Well, for the next half hour, Sophie Grove will be keeping company with Monocle's international playlist. And then at 1900 hours, it's Culture with the one and only Mr. Robert Bound. And at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. And this show, back at the same time tomorrow, of course. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.